initially 20% of the fleet will have an incorporated helmet. And yes, I couldn't get it to fit my big head. And the company was very shocked by that. I said, there's a lot of information stored in here over the years. So you just never met anybody like me.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
And I'm Geek Life reporter Kurt Slosser.
We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we get to report each day on what's happening around us in tech, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. Coming up this week, we will talk about the future of cities and a new skyscraper concept that had a lot of people buzzing in Seattle this week, plus the latest in a series of scooters have hit the streets of Seattle. And Kurt Slosser, our colleague, has tested this variant out, and he'll tell us about it. But first, John, I wanted to make sure folks knew about the new podcast that you're co-hosting from GeekWire called 2025 Tomorrow Today. This debuted earlier this week. People in the GeekWire feed got a sneak peek of it. What's your elevator pitch for this one, John?
Yeah, this is a fun new podcast that we're doing where we are looking into the future and we are exploring topics such as the future of retail, the future of work, the future of cities, which we're talking a little bit about here today. Yeah, I think everyone should check it out.
So that is 2025 Tomorrow Today. You can find it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen. So be sure to check that out. John, I learned a lot from that first episode on the future of shopping malls. And I know you've got some interesting ones coming up on Amazon as well. So looking forward to that. But let's jump into our own podcast here. Hey, Kurt, it's your triumphant return to the podcast. It's great to have you back.
Nice to be back.
Nice. You had some really fascinating stories this week that we want to dig into, including our first story, which is all about Seattle 2030. It's a new skyscraper concept, the post-pandemic skyscraper concept. This looks amazing, and people are probably going to have to go check out the site to see just how kind of crazy this giant skyscraper proposal, not proposal, it's just sort of a concept, as we said, is. I mean, this is like towering over the Columbia Center, which is currently the largest building in the city. But there's all sorts of implications here for the future of cities and what things are going to be like after we're through this hellscape that we're in right now. So, Kurt, you talked to the designers, the architects who came up with this idea. Can you give us a rundown on what Seattle 2030 is?
Yeah, Seattle 2030. It's really weird to think about 2030 when we're just so rooted in the misery of 2020. But maybe this is the light at the end of a decade tunnel for us. But this firm that has a connection to Seattle, they're called 3Mix. They are mainly based out of Asia, did this design concept for sort of the skyscraper of the future. And an architect, a partner there by the name of Ro Schroff, came up with this concept, you know, like a, you know how you look at concept cars and you're like, oh, they'll never build that thing. Well, this is the skyscraper equivalent of that, except these people are passionate about this being the answer to a lot of problems. And some of them of those problems have been born in the pandemic, whether it's social distancing or the need for cleanliness and reduced footprint for workspace and all that sort of stuff. So this thing meets the bill on everything you would imagine a sort of futuristic piece of the skyline would bring. It's got a skyport at the top with like a drone style vehicle taking off. There's a cloud walk that's like see-through. I mean, the thing's 1300 feet tall, so it's far and above taller than the Columbia Center. And it doesn't have a specific location in mind, but downtown core is sort of where they drew it. And there's a lot of nature incorporated. There's sky parks, there's trees growing, you know, 40 stories in the air. There's water walls. So lots of crazy stuff.
We can talk about what this says and what the implications are for how these architects at least think that we'll live in an urban setting after the pandemic. But I loved your description of it, Kurt. You said in the story, constructed predominantly of mass timber with a hybrid system of steel exoskeletal frames and concrete cores. It's a hexagonal configuration defined by three interconnected sub-towers with a central multi-storied void. There's a Cloud Walk Observatory, as you said. But as this thing is giant, and the whole idea is really it's a city in a skyscraper. That's what I took away from it in terms of what they're trying to do.
And that's definitely the intention. It's to bring your workspace, your living space, your leisure space all into one footprint, so to speak. And, you know, that the idea of living where you work, we're in that now, aren't we? So maybe this tower concept 10 years from now is going to further sort of solidify that this architect who came up with this is just really not into the idea of fleeing for the suburbs or other remote locales just because we're all scared of being crowded into cities now. Quite the opposite. I think he thinks we should just go taller and do it better.
How did you get a sense of how much this is a pipe dream versus a reality? I mean, I read your story and I was like, oh, you know, this guy's just kind of, you know,
yeah,
smoking some grass or something and came up with this concept, you know, because it seemed way out there and like not based in reality. But I'm curious, like, do you think there's a chance that this actually could take root in Seattle, a skyscraper of this enormity and style?
I think probably the biggest challenge would be from the FAA, and you know, nothing that tall has been approved. I feel like I've written about something else that wanted to be super tall in Seattle. Most people get scared of the earthquake sort of ramifications around something that tall, even though those buildings are built to move with the ground. But yeah, just think about what they want to do at the tippy top of this thing with you know, drone landings and drone ports. And I think there is a fantastical element to this. It's sort of what sparks the imagination, and then you sort of dial it all back and come at what's more realistic. He said political will is probably the biggest obstacle to doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, and as we know in Seattle, there's essentially political will to do nothing.
But if you look at this, I think the concept car comparison is apt. Those are not about proposing a specific automobile that's going to be driving the roads someday. They're about starting a conversation and presenting a point of view about where we're headed. And to me, that's what's most interesting about this. Yeah, the pictures are really cool and amazing. And actually, I look at this and go, the world's going to hell. Maybe I do want to live here. But his bigger point is cities are not going away. And maybe this is one way that we could end up living, working, existing in them.
Yeah. And I think the biophilic nature of the built environment is a big conversation now. You know, the Amazon spheres are that, the bringing of green space into our living and working space. So I don't think it's far-fetched to come at it from that. And the mass timber component of this feels like the second or third time I've written about that desire, which is a big deal in the Northwest where the timber industry is still relevant. There, I wrote a story about an architect in Seattle who wants to rebuild the West Seattle Bridge out of mass timber instead of concrete and steel predominantly. So each time one of those stories comes across, I'm like, oh, here's another one. This idea is gaining traction.
The thing that I found really interesting, Kurt, was contrasting this story with a story that Crosscut published this week on what's called these 15-minute cities. And the two ideas kind of parallel and actually kind of intersect to some degree. The whole concept here, to summarize this piece, it was a great piece, essentially is everything in your city should be within a 15-minute walk from you. So libraries, restaurants, grocery stores, healthcare services. And I actually think this is a more realistic concept when it comes to future of cities. I guess I know what you're saying. The skyscraper itself is perhaps a 15-minute city in and of itself. Everything is there. But I don't know. I almost see, like, when you think about the future of the city, you could almost have the neighborhoods serving as pods. And they already kind of do this to some degree in Seattle, where there's a really vibrant and strong neighborhood system. But you could imagine, you know, if they got zoned differently, if these neighborhoods got zoned differently, they could then have more industry, more commercial uses. And you truly are living very close to your workplace, your healthcare services, your schools, And it seems like there's more infrastructure to support this concept in a place like Seattle, where there are healthcare services and schools and grocery stores. I mean, the problem with downtown Seattle is you don't have any of that. There aren't any grocery stores, or there are very few, and very few schools nearby. And so this story was really interesting, and it's actually being studied pretty aggressively by the powers that be in Seattle to try to create a plan, an urban plan around this concept. So I don't know. It was just interesting that that story hit at the same time this kind of fantastic, enormous skyscraper concept came on, because I think they're kind of thinking about things in the same way, but not quite. So I don't know. I know you had some thoughts on that too.
Well, I do agree that the downtown core would love to think of itself as a neighborhood, not just a place that people drive into, go to the office, or at least pre-COVID did, and then leave at night and vacate. You know, the whole idea is that people would stay and live there and do things there and be entertained there. And I feel like that's going to be harder to convince people of after this pandemic. And you know, we've all retreated to our neighborhoods for the past 8 months or whatever it's been. And I've found that everything I need is right here. I haven't, you know, had to go downtown for anything.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, when you look at a company from the Seattle region that's really altered its headquarters concept, REI, which recently sold its headquarters complex that it spent many years building in this beautiful complex out in Bellevue, in the suburbs of Seattle. And they, after selling that to Facebook, their concept, which they're still baking out a little bit, but they're going to kind of create these locations, geographic locations throughout the city with different pods set up. And so I see that as a real interesting model, that you don't really have a headquarters, but you got little crash pad landing zones around the city. And if you work for, let's use the REI example, and you live in Everett, you go to the Everett pod. And if you work for REI and you live in Renton, you go to the Renton pod. And there are 6 or 8 of these around. And I don't know. I think that is more realistic than this idea of the big campus or the big, you know, skyscraper downtown where everybody has to go into. I don't know. My gut says that it could be a really interesting way that things evolve and come out of COVID.
To me, I think you can see a new world emerging where we are at home for most of the week or most of the month, and we go into the office once a week or 3 times a month. I think that, to me, is potentially the place where we're headed, some combination of that. And then the big question becomes, okay, what about transportation from the place that you're living an hour or two out of the city to make it more affordable for yourself into the city? And then once you get into the city, how do you get around? And that, in fact, is the subject of another story that Kurt did this week about a brand new scooter program and a unique twist on the scooter in Seattle. So let's take a break and we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to GeekWire.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook and Kurt Schlosser. And Kurt, you've been covering these urban mobility issues really in effect this week, and you experienced one of them. And I think we can tie this into our larger conversation about the future of cities, because this is a way to get around on a scooter that is very different from some of the other types of scooters that we've seen out there. This is called Wheels. Can you explain what this particular scooter is?
Yeah, Wheels is the third of three options in the City of Seattle's scooter share program, which Lime and Link are the other two companies. And those two are pretty similar. They have the stand-up model where you stand and hold the handlebars. And we've all seen those. They're in other cities pretty heavily. And Seattle has just opened up to this beyond their bike share program that they have. So Wheels started deploying this week. And I wanted to ride this one because it has a seat. It's a sit-down scooter that looks like a little bike. Not a, a new concept, but new in Seattle and new in the face of these other two that are the stand-up variety. So I test rode one, and it was the most horrible day. It was pouring this week, and it was cold and windy. And that made it perfect because I really wanted to see whether the elements or any of the infrastructure in the city would make riding this thing difficult. And it held up well.
Kurt, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Just, I need some clarity here.
Okay.
A scooter to me means you've got one foot kind of on the pad and the other one's flying away free. This is like, what's the difference between a scooter and what Wheels is doing, which looks like just kind of a modified electric bike? Why don't they call this an electric bike?
Well, the handlers who I dealt with on Tuesday, they did call it a bike. They kept calling it a bike, I should say. But the city of Seattle is running a scooter share program, and they prefer that you call it a scooter.
Yeah, but there's no pedals. That's the fundamental signature difference.
Oh, there's no pedals. That's a big difference.
Yeah. No. Yeah, there's no pedals, and there's no pushing on the other two either. Your idea of a scooter is probably from the last time you rode one, which was when you were 8. So,
yeah. Okay. No, that's a good clarification. I did not think about the pedals and the propulsion from the pedals. There's none of that. Got it.
They're all electric. They are motor driven, and they have a battery embedded in the frame.
Now, on the Lime scooters, Kurt, you actually do have to give yourself a little bit of a kickstart. You have to push with your leg to get yourself going, and then the electricity will kick in once you hit the throttle.
Just to get going. Yeah.
What about on this, on the Wheels? How did they work?
No. You sit down, you put your feet on two pegs where the pedals would normally be, and it takes off. Top speed is 15 miles an hour. It's got a little digital readout between the two hand grips. Your right grip is your throttle. Left grip is a bell. You can Bluetooth connect your phone to the thing. It's got a speaker that'll play music, and it'll play directions if you're running a map app through your phone. It's got disc brakes, so it brakes rather well. And the biggest thing it has is bigger wheels, like 14-inch wheels and a wider tire. So the stand-up scooters have pretty small wheels. So I rode this thing over some pretty gnarly train tracks down in Ballard, just trying to get a feel for, you know, how sketchy it would be. And I would not have been comfortable doing that on a stand-up one. I probably would have ate it. It felt like a little BMX bike. I think I put in my story that I was really tempted to take it off some sweet jumps.
I'm sure people will be doing that. You know, one of the other cool things about this, the wheel scooter, is that it also comes with a helmet that you could unlock. Although I know you had some problems having it adjust to your own head. But to me, that's a pretty big deal that these scooters, I mean, I'm not a fan of them because I think they're super dangerous, and you get people that are buzzing along on the Burke Gilman Trail in Seattle and they're going 15 miles an hour with zero experience and they run into me walking my dog, you know? So I'm not a huge fan, but thank God they at least with Wheels, they're coming with helmets, right?
Yeah. These ones, initially 20% of the fleet will have an incorporated helmet. It's like a little cage over the back wheel that unlocks when you unlock the bike through the app. You can elect not to unlock the helmet and it'll stay in its position if you have your own helmet or if you choose to live dangerously and not wear one. But the helmets have a removable biodegradable liner that you can pull out of there. So you can sort of have a clean start to your ride. And yes, I couldn't get it to fit my big head. And the company was very shocked by that, even though they are adjustable. I said, there's a lot of information stored in here over the years. So you just never met anybody like me. And you know, as far as the whole safety aspect of the thing and who rides these and how much they pay attention to, you know, the rules of the road or the trail as you have it. There's only so many stickers you can put on the actual device to make people be responsible. I mean, you know, look at where they place these things around bars and around, you know, neighborhoods where people are probably getting on them after being silly or whatever. And they ride them to the stadiums. It, we've all seen the videos of how poorly people can do on these. Any sharing device.
This to me gets back to the original conversation we were having, because it's in part about infrastructure. And John, I agree with you completely. I rode a scooter in Washington, D.C., and their rules were very similar to ours in that you cannot ride the scooters on the sidewalk. But the problem is, you're taking your life into your hands if you ride one of these things in the street, and yet you're taking other people's lives into your hands if you try and do a electric scooter on a sidewalk. And don't get me started on Seattle's rules about the ability to ride your bike on the sidewalk, which is crazy. Oh, and the fact that cyclists have the right of way in crosswalks. That is the worst. Oh my God, I just got myself started. So yes, there are scenarios where the rules, the laws, what's allowed here in Seattle in terms of bikes is extremely dangerous because of the way that bikes can jut out into crosswalks in ways that cars may not see them. But anyway, that aside, I feel like the infrastructure of the city is not really ready for these transportation solutions that are sort of being thrust upon us. And so then where does that get us? Because the whole idea here, ideally, is you come up with something more environmentally friendly. You're not getting in your car. This tower that we talked about in downtown Seattle could be something that somebody could get to in a reasonable way from a light rail station that might be nearby. You know, you start to see this interconnected nature, and it's just not there right now.
Kurt, the other thing that surprised me, and I would like to get your take on this. You rode for 12 minutes and 21 seconds, and your total cost was $5.68. That seemed pricey to me. And I thought that maybe the concept was these are going to be more accessible types of transportation, but that's substantially more expensive than riding a bus.
Yeah, I mean, it's a buck to unlock and 36 cents a minute or something like that.
Did you think it was like, I know you were kind of out for a thrill ride in the rain, so maybe you weren't caring as much, but did you think the price was pricey or too pricey when you saw the final bill?
I was a little surprised considering I was soaking wet and I forgot to use my GeekWire credit card. I felt a little annoyed by the price.
Well, we'll reimburse you. We'll buy a pint or something and then send you out on the wheels.
There's a lot of grief that these companies get for how people leave these things. You know, they're a hazard on the sidewalk or they impede people's accessibility. This was the first time I used one of these where it wanted me to take a picture of how I parked it in order to close out of my transaction. I had to answer three questions. Did you leave it near a doorway or did you leave it, you know, in a crosswalk? And then it said, take a picture. And I'm like trying to get the scooter inside the little frame that it gives you. If they don't agree with that, you've parked it in a reasonable way, you get a $5 fine from Wheels. The two people I was with said, don't worry about that. They're not going to fine you. But I think that was just because it was me.
Because you were reporting on it, I'm sure. And your good looks. I loved the caption on this. I gave Kurt a hard time on the caption on this. It said, GeekWire reporter Kurt Schlosser seated on a Wheels electric scooter during a test ride in Seattle this week. For reference, Schlosser is 6 feet tall. And I told him, I said, Kurt, I edited that for you. I added with a chiseled jaw and a striking good looks.
You said size 14 feet. I didn't want people to think I was like 8 feet tall on a 5 foot tall bike or, yeah, you know, 3 feet tall on a giant bike. I don't know. No. I thought it was very helpful reporting.
It's giving you a hard time. That was a legitimate journalistic reference. Go ahead.
Kurt, are you a Wheels customer now after this experience? Do you think you would continue using this into the future?
I have a lot of bicycle comfort. I like getting around my neighborhood and the city on a bike. I'm not afraid to ride in traffic or, use one of the trails. So this to me feels like the one I would use the most.
All right. So that is Wheels. It's the third in three scooter share programs now available in Seattle just in time. It's November, so of course they're launching right now. Lime, Link, and now Wheels. Try them out. Let us know what you think of them. But we've got a little bit more business to take care of here on the GeekWire podcast, because as many folks will remember, last week we reintroduced the GeekWire trivia contest with a chance for all the listeners out there to win a GeekWire mask. And coming up, we're going to give the answer to last week's trivia contest and name the winner of that limited edition GeekWire swag. That's coming up next. All right, welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook and Kurt Schlosser. Last week, we talked about Tom Ahlberg from Adorna Venture Group and the profile that our colleague Lisa Stifler wrote about him. And there was a little piece of trivia in the story that I wanted to call out, in part because it's just a lot of fun. It gets into the whole issue of satellite broadband, which is a big issue right now. The question was, back in the 1990s, Tom Ahlberg was involved in a satellite broadband venture. It was funded by two prominent moguls in the Seattle tech region. What was the venture and who were the moguls? One of my favorite words, by the way. Mogul is a great headline word, for what it's worth. John, do you know the answer to that question?
I believe it's Teledesic.
That's right. That's right.
And the billionaires would have been?
Yes.
Did you ask for Seattle area billionaires? Because there was another billionaire involved as well.
I did say Seattle area, if I remember correctly.
So the billionaires would have been Bill Gates and Craig McCaw.
That's exactly right. Who was the other one?
There was a Saudi prince who I believe was a pretty big backer of Teledesic as well. Now, you might need to fact check me on that. Maybe that'll be the trivia question this week. It was the Saudi prince that was a backer of Teledesic. I'll fact check myself now.
Yeah, you covered this company, though. Before you go off into your Google hole there, what was this company about? Tell us, because a lot of folks didn't know this one.
Yeah, I mean, really, and by the way, I did pull up a Wired story from 1998, headline, Saudi Prince drops $200 million on Teledesic. So there you go. Teledesic was a pretty interesting concept, and you kind of see it replicating now in the current world. Essentially, they were creating a constellation of satellites that was going to beam down internet connectivity to us anywhere here on planet Earth. And so it's a really, really obviously capital intensive business, and but with a real need for it when you think about high bandwidth to remote areas or getting access to people that might not have internet connectivity. And you've seen it play out with, you know, Google, Facebook, others are certainly in the market of trying to roll out these types of services even to this day. So it's like a lot of these ventures that got started early and that were very capital intensive, great concept, solid team, good backing, but just didn't hit the market, you know, at the right time, and they failed. And now you see the next generation of companies that are chasing essentially the same concept.
This company, Teledesic, closed in 2002, and they blamed the collapse of the telecom industry at the time, which I imagine was tied in part to the bust from 2000 of dot-coms, the whole fallout from that. But John, one person guessed Terabeam, which that sounded a little familiar too. Was that beaming internet through office buildings or something? Am I remembering that one right?
Yes, yes. They had an intense, innovative, creative system where they had created these devices that were going to sit in various office towers. So like the, you know, skyscraper that Kurt talked about, you know, maybe the Terabeam device in 2030 can make an appearance in there. But the concept was essentially you would beam high-speed internet connectivity between various buildings and create a really robust network. And they also, again, not a bad idea, but they also imploded shortly after the dot-com bust.
Now, I believe that was also a Madrona Venture Group investment, Terabeam, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I don't think it was, Todd.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to fact check that in the same form that you just fact checked your Saudi prince investment in Teledesic.
Oh, wait, I'm wrong. You're right.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you are right. I did not think it was, but they were a backer. Yes, good on you.
Well, chances are it's kind of like all the Johns in my neighborhood, like we talked about a couple weeks ago. You know, if you name a company, chances are Madrona was an investor in it if it was from
That's
Seattle.
That's true. We're really in the history books here on this trivia question. Hopefully people who've been around Seattle for 20 plus years are really, really grokking this.
hey, well, even if you weren't, you know, it's good to know the history. I think that's one true. Of the cool things about these conversations, as long as we don't dwell on it too long. So let's jump out of this conversation and let you know that the winner was, and congrats to Louis Zabelli, who knew the answer to this and was chosen at random from the pool of correct answers to win a limited edition GeekWire mask. So Louis, I sent you an email. Respond to that. Give me your address and we'll get that in the mail to you. And we will be back next week with a new installment in the GeekWire Trivia Challenge. So come back next week. And in the meantime, if you want to share your opinion on any of the topics that we talked about this week, it's very easy. Just take out your phone, record a memo, 30 to 60 seconds, and send it on email to podcast@geekwire.com. And we will consider it for inclusion in a future show. Let us know your name and a couple details about you so we can understand who you are and share your thoughts on the topics that we talked about on this week's show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com. And be sure to sign up for our daily email newsletter to catch all of our headlines. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
And I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
And I'm Geek Life reporter Kurt Schlosser.
We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.